the setting of Vespa's music known as Delle Cinque Laudate, included by Cavalli in his last publication of religious music before his death, a moving work that seems to be in keeping with the composer's advanced time of life. We heard it sung by the Claudio Monteverdi Choir of Crema with the Quoniam Ensemble of Renaissance Bassoons and the Ensemble de Sacboutier, conducted by Bruno Gini. In tomorrow's programme, we'll be looking at Cavalli's parallel career in the world of music theatre.
And that was Donald MacLeod. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, and it's time to go live now to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's BBC Proms. And it's presented by someone who's fast becoming our Paris correspondent, Rob Cowan.
Thank you very much, Ian, and a warm welcome from me here at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom, the second of two, given by the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France under its music director, Myung-Woon Chung. In about 10 minutes, something powerful and lyrical, a concerto that marked the reconciliation of two close friends, the glow of Brahms's Concerto for Violin and Cello, which in tonight's prom context means the fraternal bonding of the brothers Renaud and Gauthier Capuçon. After the interval, we've a riot-inducing ballet that before the First World War changed the face of music forever, the festival of ritual and rhythm that's Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. But first this evening, Oberon, or The Elf King's Oath, a three-act romantic opera, originally in English, with spoken dialogue and music by Carl Maria von Weber. The libretto, by James Robinson Planchet, was based on a German poem, which itself was based on a French medieval romance, though it's the German translation that we most often hear nowadays. Oberon was first performed at Covent Garden here in London in 1826, and we're going to hear the overture, which opens to a mysterious forest of horns and strings, with skipping woodwinds as fairies that yield to a jaunty brass theme. The rest is powerful and energetic, with a brief recollection of the introduction. No mere operatic potpourri then, but genuine tone poetry. And it's great to hear a Weber overture in concert. There are a good many of them, and we too rarely hear them, principally because they don't fit the standard grid of modern concert planning. Well, that applause is from Myung-Woon Chung, who now conducts Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France in Weber's Oberon Overture.
Thank you.
Well, I'd call that the perfect concert opener. Weber's Oberon Overture, performed there by the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung-Hun Chung. Interesting there that he used a baton, which he didn't use in rehearsal. He believes in keeping rehearsals quite cool and leaving the flames for the concert. He calculates quite carefully, actually. He's a very analytical conductor in rehearsal. Well, next this evening, heartwarming evidence that taking sides on the issue of a doomed relationship can occasionally lead to good. Johannes Brahms forged a deep friendship with the great violinist Joseph Joachim that was to last virtually half a century. But there was a hiccup in 1884 when Joachim suspected his wife Amelie of being romantically involved with Brahms's publisher. Brahms took Amelie's side and wrote to her supporting letter that when Joachim sued Amelie for divorce years later, was offered at the trial as a character reference and helped the court decide in her favour. Eventually, the two men were reconciled, the proof being the double concerto we're about to hear, which Clara Schumann actually called a work of reconciliation, written during the summer of 1887 on the shores of Lake Thun, with the tellingly cryptic inscription, "To him for whom it was written." Tonight's soloists are the brothers Capuçon, Gautier on cello and Renaud on violin. I caught up with them after rehearsals and asked them what this piece means to them.
This is the piece for violin and cello. This is the reference. It's also the Fifth Symphony in a way, and the cello concerto that Brahms never wrote. It is also this reconciliation piece between Joachim and Brahms, and I think for two brothers it's quite nice because, as you know, when you are brothers, you sometimes you fight, then you don't fight, then you fight again, and it's all life like this. It's a family thing. So in a way, to play this piece is always a kind of getting back together. It's a lot of joy and a lot of fun.
Now, you recorded it in 2007, didn't you? Do you feel that your interpretation has evolved since that recording was made 4 years ago?
It's very funny because I just recently found a video on YouTube, which was made of one of our concerts 3 years ago in Germany. And I was actually very surprised to listen a little bit to this concert, because of course I recognize us, of course it is us, but both of us personally in our life, since then we both became fathers, you experience different things. And so when we come back together, there is this experience and this life that we share together and which grow our interpretation of the poems.
Breno and Gauthier Capuçon, they're talking about the Brahms double concerto, which we're about to hear. It's interesting that the biographer of Brahms, Richard Specht, described it as one of Brahms's most unapproachable and joyless compositions. Obstinate and mechanical, he said, cold and rigid. Even the bright passages wear a frozen smile, and the workings out are like equations. Only here and there does a melodic bud timidly peep from behind the cracks of a solid wall. Absolutely amazing that anybody could hear this wonderful, warm, glowing music like that. And it, of course, has been a favourite with a great many partnerships, sometimes family partnerships like the Capuçons. Fritz and Adolf Busch, many years ago, used to play it regularly. The music of Brahms, by the way, is just one of many threads running through this year's prom season. There's a very interesting article by Stephen Johnson in the Proms Guide, and you can find details of all the concerts, of course, on the Proms website at bbc.co.uk/proms. You might also be interested to know as well that tonight's conductor, Myung-Woon Chung, is a featured artist in Classical Collection on Radio 3 every day this week. That's at 10 a.m. And well, there's plenty more going on, of course, involving the great classics at the Proms. And this orchestra has quite a history of playing music. Ah, now I see just our two soloists are about to come on. And that applause for the brothers Capuçon. Reno playing the violin and Gauthier the cello, who with the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France under Myung-Woon Chung will now perform Brahms' glorious double concerto.
Thank you.
Brothers in perfect harmony. Brahms' double concerto, played by Renaud Capuçon on violin, with Gauthier Capuçon playing the cello, and Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung-Woon Chung. Now that was a pretty interesting interpretation, especially the first movement, some of which was exceedingly broad and romantic, a very wide variety of tempos. Perhaps you'd like to write a review. Go to our website, bbc.co.uk/proms. I, for one, would be very interested to see what you write. Well, Brahms, a great composer of chamber music, of course, and there are times when the writing for the violin and cello there sounds almost like a string quartet. Mind you, the playing of the Capuçons has got something to do with that. Wonderful sonority. And here they come again with Myung-Woon Chung, and the orchestra rises to its feet. A performance of great exuberance and considerable character. The double was the nearest that Brahms ever got to writing a cello concerto. In fact, when he saw Dvorak's concerto, he said, "Why didn't I write one?" A terrible shame he didn't, mind you. That's such a beautiful work, that double concerto. Myung-Woon Chung, a distinguished conductor of romantic music. Talking about Dvorak, I asked him this morning, he'd recorded Dvorak's Third Symphony, and I asked him whether he was going to record a cycle. He did a couple of them. He said, "I don't do cycles," but he thought the third was a particularly beautiful work, and he'd performed it a lot in his youth. Here they come again, the Capuçon brothers. Greatly appreciated here. Here we go. We have an encore. Now, I'm going to go on iPlayer tomorrow and I'm going to listen to that performance I don't know how many times. And that was absolutely brilliant playing of the Halvorsen arrangement of the harpsichord Passacaglia from the Suite No. 7 in G minor by Handel. That a favourite encore of Nigel Kennedy and Lynn Harrell and of High Fix and Piano Gorsuch. My goodness, that's just about the best performance of that music I think I've ever heard by Renault and Gautier. Capuçon, absolutely brilliant. And here they come again. Well, you could hear the audience go wild, and I really think in that case it was totally justified. Somehow I've got the feeling they've played that piece a few times. There actually aren't that many duos for violin and cello, but as an encore, that's a particular favourite. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the proms. In just over 20 minutes, Orchestra Philharmonique de Radio France will be back with Stravinsky's epic Rite of Spring Ballet. But before that, Stravinsky and the King's Horse, in which Philip Bullock considers the links between two events that took place in the summer of 1913. The first occurred at the Derby.
King's Horse brought down. Woman and jockey injured.
This was the headline that greeted readers of the Morning Post on June 5th, 1913, the day after Emily Wilding Davison, a 40-year-old suffragette, threw herself in front of the King's Horse at the Derby. The horse recovered. So did the jockey. But Emily Davison, though she survived for 4 days, was to die from her injuries and became perhaps the most famous martyr for the suffragette cause. A little over a month later, on July the 11th, the Ballet Russe gave the first London performance of The Rite of Spring, with music by Igor Stravinsky, designed by Nikolai Rurich, and choreography by Vaclav Nijinsky. The ballet culminates in the death of a woman, a young virgin sacrificed by her community in order to bring about the arrival of spring. It seems to me that there's a connection to be made between The Rite of Spring and Emily Davison's fate. Two moments in the summer of 1913, linked by ideas of sacrifice, the public destruction of women's bodies, and a challenge to the artistic and political values of the old order. It's this connection I'm setting out to explore here. The world premiere of The Rite of Spring in Paris on May the 29th, 1913, had ended in one of the most infamous riots in musical history. As far as the organisers of the Ballet Russe were concerned, the scandal was no bad thing. It guaranteed the fame of the ballet for years to come, and is still the one thing that most people probably remember about it. Members of the company, Marie Rambert and Lydia Sokolova, both recalled the event for the BBC in the 1960s.
When the performance started and the curtain went up, for a moment there was complete silence of shock to what the people saw. So far they hadn't heard anything, and then on their ears came these outrageous chords of the sacrosanto, and they started beating their feet and shouting. They interfered with us to such an extent that by the end of the first act, which was the most difficult part of the whole ballet to dance, because there were groups of people running round and passing each other, but each group was doing something different, you see. Well, how could you concentrate and count and accent every movement with all that hubbub going on out there?
We couldn't hear the music, we couldn't count, and it went on. Then a woman bent out of her box and slapped a man who was clapping. Other people were slapped because they were hissing. It was a most dreadful scandal.
I know people have said that it was the ballet itself and the music that caused this tremendous uproar. But a lot of rumour had gone around Paris, you know, for quite a time, that this was a completely new era, that all the old artists were being pushed aside, and so on. Here we were with this modern sound and this modern movement and modern decor. Well, all this was worked up into some sort of frenzy, of almost hatred of a change in the artistic world in Paris.
When the work opened in London, however, reactions were generally more positive. Although the British have never been quite as enthusiastic about the avant-garde as the French have, audiences and critics seem more open-minded. Even those who disliked the ballet tended to be ironic or bemused rather than scandalised. The reviewer for the Daily Mail, for instance, wittily described the Rite of Spring as
24 dances danced by 24 dancers to 24 different tunes played simultaneously.
Russian art was rather in vogue in the years before the war. Constance Garnett's new translation of Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, had been published in 1912, giving rise to what some critics have dubbed Russian fever in literary circles. Later that year, Roger Fry's second post-impressionist exhibition included works by a number of modern Russian artists. The Ballet Russe had first visited London in 1911, bringing with them a succession of ballets and operas by Russian and European composers, performed by a new generation of talented dancers and singers, and with luxurious sets and costumes by leading artists. The effect was immediate, and both high society and highbrow intellectuals flocked to Covent Garden and Drury Lane to see these exciting and exotic new works. The founder of the Ballet Russe was Sergei Diaghilev, and one of his most important artistic innovations was the prominence he gave to the male body in his productions. The leading dancer in the company was Vaclav Nijinsky, and audiences turned out to see him perform roles such as the melancholic puppet hero of Stravinsky's Petrushka, or the erotic solo part in L'Après-midi d'un Faune with music by Debussy. A number of the early ballets that Nijinsky danced were choreographed by Michal Fokin, and histories of the company often emphasise the coterie of male dancers and choreographers who were at the heart of Diaghilev's enterprise. This sense of the Ballet Russe as a distinctly male world is reinforced by the knowledge that Diaghilev and Nijinsky were lovers for a time. But the Rite of Spring was rather different. Not only did its crucial final solo go to a female dancer, but women played a central part in bringing the work to the stage. Ramsey Burt is Professor of Dance History at De Montfort University in Leicester.
Diaghilev has showcased the Ballet Russe around Nijinsky rather than Pavlova or Kasavna, the two ballerinas. Pavlova leaves because she can't cope with being second fiddle to Nijinsky. But here Nijinsky is choreographer and not performing in it. He'd always worked very closely with his sister Bronislava Nijinska, who was also a highly trained, very, very skilled, incredibly intelligent dancer. When he starts on The Rite of Spring, he starts with the final solo and he starts with making it for her. And what he doesn't know is that she's pregnant. And it's such a violent role, jumping, throwing herself on the floor. After a while, she has to step out. The solo has been completed, but she has to say, I can't do this.
The ballerina who eventually took the solo role, first conceived for Nijinsky's sister, was Maria Piltz. Her performance in the final sacrificial solo seems to have delighted everybody, whatever else they thought of Nijinsky's deliberately graceless choreography.
Even when they don't like it, they think that Maria Piltz is wonderful, whatever. The records we have of the riot in Paris, the one moment when everyone calms down and watches is for Piltz's solo, which is the final sacrificial solo. She's the one who dances herself to death, that the tribe have tried everything else to bring about spring and everything fails. And the moment she dies, the men rush in and lift her up because she can't touch the earth if she's being sacrificed to the sun.
One of the most challenging aspects of The Rite of Spring was Stravinsky's music, with its irregular phrase lengths and complicated rhythms that were quite unlike anything previously used in ballet. In order to help the dancers come to terms with the score, Diaghilev turned to another woman, whose expertise and intelligence could help him achieve his aims, Marie Rambert, speaking here in 1966.
First of all, it was a question of choosing the phrases of the music. And then Nijinsky got the basic position, because the thing was prehistoric rites, you see, and he found the essential position with the feet very turned in and the hands, like little, he used to call it little fists, like that, turned in. And very barbaric looking. The chief thing was that people beat out the rhythm with their feet and the groupings.
So in a way, Nijinska, Bronislava Nijinska, Marie Rombert and Maria Pilz, the three women who are at the heart of this, and I think their role in it tends to get ignored. I think the ballet can look slightly differently if you look at it from a kind of female point of view and women's responses to modernism and modernity.
It is this sense of the importance of the Rite of Spring in women's history that links it to Emily Davison, the suffragette who had thrown herself under the King's Horse at the Derby earlier that summer. Both events put a woman at the centre of things, a woman so committed to bringing about change and transformation that she sacrifices her body for the sake of her community. Historical hindsight allows us to see the potential parallels between the Rite of Spring and the suffragettes. But at the time, no one seemed to have commented on the similarities between the fate of the Chosen One and that of Emily Davison. However, an anonymous article in the Daily Mail entitled A Letter of an Englishman did criticise both Nijinsky and the suffragettes for their iconoclastic attitude to tradition.
The spirit of the age has gone to Monsieur Nijinsky's head, as it has gone to the head of many other artists. The same lawlessness, the same contempt of order which afflicts the politics of today, afflicts also the humanities. The virtue most highly prized is the virtue of novelty. A fierce hatred of beauty drives the advanced champions of all the arts into a wild revolt against tradition. True image-breakers, they would destroy, if they could, all the trophies of the past. Discarding the wise lessons of centuries, they would recreate the world anew, and the implements of their creation are the hammer and the bomb. Monsieur Marinetti, the Italian futurist, and the militant suffragette differ only in the object of their attack.
It's not clear whether the writer had Emily Davison in mind here, but it's interesting to note that he sees the suffragettes as artists rather than politicians. Like the Italian futurist Marinetti, they were radical and avant-garde in both their art and their politics, committed to destroying the values of the past and pursuing innovation for its own sake. And if the suffragettes were artists, then their medium wasn't paint and canvas, but their own bodies. Because they lacked the vote and were often unable to speak in public, they came up with novel ways of using their own bodies as a form of political self-expression. Emily Davison was no exception to this, and even before she used her body to make the ultimate sacrifice, she had found other ingenious ways to get her point across. During the 1911 census, for instance, she spent the night in a broom cupboard at the House of Commons. There were, of course, no women MPs there at the time, but by spending the night in the Commons, Davison could legitimately give her place of residence as the Palace of Westminster. Ramsay Burt again.
What a smart thing to do. What an imaginative thing to do. And it's putting her body in there. She doesn't want to be in the census because the census is used to make the electoral rolls, but she's not going to be given the vote. It's a very clever protest. And it seems to me that what the suffragettes are doing, they're almost like performance artists, thinking of really clever things to do with their bodies. They're very much aware of themselves as performers. The incident, I think it's 1911, where lots of suffragettes go to the fashionable shops in Bond Street, and as the clock strikes four, they produce from their dainty little handbags hammers and they smash all the shop windows, you know, all simultaneously. It's almost like a flash mob. There's a kind of parallel there, ingenuity, almost UK uncut. It seems so modern, that kind of imagination, consciousness of performing and performing for the media.
By using their bodies as instruments of ideology, the suffragettes were challenging both the political system and expectations about how women should behave. Their daring actions were like an artistic spectacle designed to shock a complacent public and raise the profile of their cause more than public speeches or letters to the newspapers could ever do. Similarly, the conclusion to the Rite of Spring features a young woman at the centre of the stage, a young woman who puts her body to the test and enacts gestures that point to a future that will be very different from the past.
There's a wonderful description of Maria Pilz recalling at the end of her life to a Russian ballet historian, recalling at the end of the first performances in Paris, where she's in the wings and Diaghilev says, you've got to go on stage and take your curtain call. And she goes on stage and she just stands there and she takes up the, there's a particular stance that she has with her hands to one side, one shoulder up, head slightly bowed, which is the pose of the sacrificial victim for the choreography. And she takes this pose up and she doesn't bow and she just stands there. And there's lots of people cheering her and just as many people booing her. And she says, and I bawled. She just cried and cried and cried. And she's finding herself at the middle of a moment where something is changing. I think that's what I think so interesting. It's a moment where something is changing, where people violently disagree and it's not stable anymore. And I think Emily Davison walking in front of the King's Horse, I mean, we don't know her intentions. She'd got a return ticket in her pocket. And does she also know that that's the corner where all the photographs will be taken, where there's a newsreel camera? She's stepping into the centre of something. But in both cases, it's a woman putting her body in the middle of something, of a moment of change that is creating violent disagreements and being at the centre of that.
But there is, of course, a huge difference between Maria Pilz dancing an imaginary death at the end of The Rite of Spring and the tragic consequences of Emily Davison's actions at the Derby. The Rite of Spring was an astute piece of artistic primitivism designed to appeal to Western taste for the exotic and the unusual. There may have been a riot at the first Paris performance, but that itself was an artistic happening, not a political crisis. Emily Davison's fate was a real sacrifice with terrible human consequences. Like many suffragettes, Emily Davison was imprisoned on several occasions for her political actions, and when, on one occasion, she embarked on a hunger strike, she was brutally force-fed. After her death, the young author and novelist Rebecca West wrote a passionate article in the socialist newspaper The Clarion, in which she accused the whole male establishment of being complicit in the torture and murder of women. Doctors, lawyers and politicians, she claimed, were doing the same thing to women that Jack the Ripper had done back in the Victorian era.
Doctors know that there is an obscene kind of madness that makes men torture women. 25 years ago, London was sick because one such maniac crept through the dark alleys of Whitechapel, mutilating and murdering unfortunate women. In those days, people cursed him, but today, Jack the Ripper works free-handed from the honourable places of government. He sits on the front bench or in those vast public sepulchres of conscience in Whitehall and works not in secret but through Home Office orders and scarlet-robed judges. Scotland Yard is at his service. The medical profession, up to the President of the Royal College of Surgeons, places its skill at his disposal, that his mutilations may be the more ingenious. And for his victims, he no longer seeks the shameful women of mean streets. To him, before the dull eyes of the unprotesting world, fall the finest women of the land, the women of the most militant honour and the wisest courage.
Rebecca West's anger is perfectly understandable. But for others, the important point was not to let Emily Davison's death pass in vain. If we think about the plot of The Rite of Spring, we can see that the death of the Chosen One at the end of the ballet only makes sense to the community that survives her. Her act of self-sacrifice becomes a gift that brings about the end of winter and the coming of spring. Likewise, Emily Davison's final act becomes a sacrifice on behalf of the suffragette community to which she had belonged and which honoured her memory after her death. Large numbers turned out to attend her funeral in London on June the 14th, 1913, recalled here on Radio 4's Woman's Hour in 1968 by fellow suffragette Grace Rowe.
Mrs. Pankhurst was under the Cat and Mouse Act and one couldn't get at her. Christopher was in Paris and I couldn't get in touch with her and it all had to be done very quickly. It was almost impossible to get even a church at the time. But there was a marvellous rally and people came together in a wonderful way, and it was a very, very, very wonderful thing. I decided that we ought to have red in as well as the purple, white and green. Some were white carrying the purple, white and green, different flowers. Some sections were black and others were purple.
and they carried their flowers, you know, to contrast. We had to do it all in a very underground way. I went over at one time to a house, the home of Mrs. Reuben Guest, and while I was there, I saw the clergy and different people, and I was in disguise. I went out into the streets there in my disguise, and I saw the whole thing.
The slogan of the suffragette movement was "Deeds, not words," and it was this phrase that was chosen for the epitaph on Emily Davison's grave. Her decision to step out in front of the King's Horse was a violent act perpetrated against the male establishment, but it was also an act she committed against herself. Such an apparently self-destructive gesture may still shock us today, yet as Ramsay Burt suggests, it also represents an astonishing assertion of human dignity in the face of a hostile and uncomprehending world.
The one thing you could say about Emily Davison stepping in front of that horse, it's a choice. She's actually choosing to do something. And in choosing, she's almost taking back that human right to choose that has been deprived by the whole judicial, medical, legislative system that justifies her being force-fed. If she did consciously decide to kill herself, then that I find that awful. And yet, there's a tragedy there around this dehumanisation and trying to get back some humanity that I think is really worth thinking about.
Familiarity with the music of the Rite of Spring means that it no longer seems quite the radical work it once was. Likewise, we may take a woman's right to vote for granted, even though universal suffrage has been around for fewer than 100 years. So when we listen to the Rite of Spring, let's forget for a moment the all-too-familiar story of the scandalous Paris premiere and the role it played in establishing the myth of the Ballet Russe and its male creators. Let's remember instead the events surrounding the London premiere in July 1913 and the way in which Emily Davison's tragic death was strangely and movingly reflected in the sacrifice of the Chosen One in the ballet's final moments.
Philip Bullock providing a thought-provoking context for the second half of tonight's prom, Stravinsky and the King's Horse, was produced by Maria Burgess, and the readers were Gerard McDermott and Susie Riddell. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the proms. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's concert, and a work that combines savage rhythmic attack with a stark and gripping atmosphere. What we're about to hear opened up, musically speaking, both heavens and chasms. It's Stravinsky's epoch-making ballet, The Rite of Spring. The rite's origins were in a sort of dream in which Stravinsky had a sudden, fleeting vision of a pagan rite where a sage and elders watched a young girl dance herself to death. They were sacrificing her to appease the god of spring. That, in essence, is what the Rite of Spring is about. Well, I caught the rehearsal this morning for the performance we're about to hear, and I was struck by Myung-Whun Chung's approach to the work. He seemed to me to really bring out its lyrical side.
Well, in all works, there's so many facets that one tries to bring out so that it is not one-dimensional, and this is certainly not one-dimensional, but if you heard my last comment, I said, okay, so now we've done what is necessary. Now I want you guys to go wild, show what kind of savages live in France. So there is an overriding, primitive, almost violent, very savage feeling to a lot of the piece, but there is also a lot of beauty in it too. So we try to bring out as much as we can.
In interpreting the rite, what is the most difficult aspect of it? Is it the balancing of it? Is it the rhythmic complexity of it? Or maybe knitting all the sections together to make a cogent whole? What poses the biggest problems?
What is most difficult for me personally is the very physical and very mental sort of rhythmic complexities and harmonic complexities to try to get the right balance between the two. The last dance, you can imagine the scene that you dance yourself literally to death, you know. But at the same time, if you go out of control, it's a mess. But if you're coolly in control, something is missing. So it's that kind of balance that is difficult to make. It can be quite exciting.
Quite exciting indeed. Well, the Rite of Spring falls into two parts. The first opens with a bassoon solo that has its woodwind family siblings curl around it like filmed jungle growth speeded up. As for the rest of the sequence, think of studies in rhythm before the procession of the sage reaches fever pitch, and four bars of quiet music that sound a bit like oranges and lemons signal a stampeding finale. The rite's second part opens exotically. There are the secret night games of the young maidens on the sacred hill. And the last dance, well, it's pretty stunning. Well, that applause is from Myung Woong Chung, who now conducts the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France and Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring.
Thank you.
Well, will that piece ever sound anything less than shockingly modern? Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, performed at tonight's prom by the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung Woon Chung. Nevertheless, his policy of playing it cool in rehearsal and letting things rip at the concert paid off. It was in that performance. Nothing like the rehearsal at all, which was good, but relatively sane. That was, well, for me, one of the best rites I've ever heard in this hall. And Myung Woon Chung comes into the centre of the orchestra, applauds them himself, and cues them to rise. And there was some spectacular playing there. Chung dancing like a marionette towards the end of the piece there, where the Virgin dances herself to death for the elders. Quite an orchestra this, when they really get going, and they were certainly showing their potential there. Now, what have we here? A couple of bouquets are coming, being brought onto the stage. Yes, and they are being given to two members of the orchestra who are retiring tonight. The bassist, Henri Voskoviak, and the violinist, Thérèse Desbeaux. And they're being embraced. Myung-Gung Chung embraces Thérèse. And Henri also being embraced by a lady. And the orchestra rises again, respecting these two players who are giving their final performance tonight with the orchestra. And here he returns again, Myung-Gung Chung, who gets the orchestra to rise. And he applauds the audience. I get the feeling that everybody's extremely happy in that orchestra tonight. They know they've excelled themselves. They were good last night, but tonight's concert, I think, has been exceptional, with sympathetic Brahms and that virtuoso and immensely strong account of the Stravinsky. Well, I don't have to tell you how the audience is reacting. You can hear it for yourself with all this. Well, what have Bizet's Carmen and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring got in common? I can tell you in one word, sex. That was the prelude to Carmen, played by the Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France, conducted by Myung-Gung Chung. And that closes their concert. Petrarch Tamorny will be here at 10 o'clock for the first of this year's late proms, when the Belcher Quartet and the cellist Valentin Erben play Schubert's great string quintet in C. And tomorrow night's prom has the Dvorak Cello Concerto, which I mentioned earlier, played by Jean-Guillaume Pierres, and the whole of Smetana's Mavlas for the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Julie Belaklavik. And that's a proms first, hearing the whole thing at a prom. But now, from me, Rob Cowan, time to hand you over to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Rob, thank you very much indeed. Rob Cowan with the first of our two proms tonight, live from the Royal Albert Hall. Don't forget that you can hear that prom again by going to the Radio 3 website and clicking on the Listen Again button. Or why not tune in to Afternoon on 3 on Thursday afternoon this week, when you can hear that concert broadcast here on BBC Radio 3. Tomorrow afternoon, incidentally, you have the chance to hear the prom we broadcast live last night, the first of those two appearances by tonight's orchestra from France, this time playing Messiaen, Pascal Duzapin and Beethoven, Renaud and Gauthier Capson's performance of the Double Concerto by Beethoven. That all begins tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And if you have firm views on tonight's performance, particularly that performance of the Stravinsky, and perhaps you'd like to offer your own review of the concert, then you can do so. Just go to the BBC Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms, then click on Share down towards the bottom right of the page and offer your views. Well, before we return to the Royal Albert Hall, our next programme tonight on Radio 3 will be a fascinating portrait of a remarkable character. It was one of the last interviews given by Leonora Carrington, who died this year at the age of 94, a surrealist painter. And the interview was conducted by her long-lost cousin, who built an exquisite programme around that interview, which was conducted in Mexico, the country that she'd made her home since eloping there with fellow surrealist Max Ernst in the 1930s, only though after fleeing from the Nazis in France, suffering a breakdown in Spain, and being institutionalised by her family in America. Looking for Leonora begins at 9:15 in just over 5 minutes' time. So music to take us there, and having heard some pretty violent music played by a French orchestra, here's some pretty gentle and reflective music by a French composer whose own touch was a remarkable one. I once heard a piano roll by César Franck playing his own compositions, and it was a perfect example of a steel claw in a velvet glove. Well, this is the playing of two musicians, Janine Jansen and Itamar Golan. Thank you. Well, I think I was affected by the feelings after the reverie myself there, après un rêve. Not by Franck, but by Fauré. Bit of confusion there. I selected the wrong track on the CD, but it was worth it all the same. Played there by Janine Jansen and Itamar Golan. However, we do have a little time to go just before our next programme, so let me make amends by playing you by music by the composer I did intend you to play to hear rather in just a moment ago. A very short piece by César Franck, played by Jörg Demus. Well, do stay with us on BBC Radio 3. We will be back at the Proms at 10 o'clock tonight to hear a late-night prom given by the Belcher Quartet, who are joined by Valentin Erben to play the string quintet in C major Deutsch 956 by Schubert, a piece composed in the very last few months of Schubert's life. But next tonight, a feature. In the May of this year, the death was announced at 94 of Leonora Carrington, a celebrated and unique surrealist artist, a friend of some of the most famous surrealist figures of the 20th century, and a British resident of Mexico. One of the last interviews she gave was to her long-lost cousin, Joanna Moorhead, and we now have a chance to hear a programme first broadcast before Leonora Carrington's death, in which Joanna Moorhead travelled to Mexico to talk to her, looking for Leonora.
You're born an artist. You don't do it, it does you.
Okay, I think it's working.
Will you say something into this and see if I can...
The time has come, the wall has said, to talk of many things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings. That's not mine.
Who is it?
I'm trying to remember, I can't.
This is Leonora Carrington, the black sheep of my family.
Well, let's see what other rhymes mine.
She scandalised them all when she eloped in 1937 to live with the surrealist painter Max Ernst. She's 93 now.
I'm almost 100, you know that.
She forgets things occasionally, but not the name of her Maltese terrier.
Where is she? Yeti.
Leonora is known in our family as Prim.
Ben Yetica. Ben.
When I arrived here to meet her for the first time, I rang the doorbell and she answered it and I said, Prim? And she said, I stopped being Prim a long time ago.
Do you want tea?
And I've called her Leonora ever since.
Do you want a tea or tequila?
I think there was a real significance for her with making a break in 1937 between being Prim, the girl she really wanted to get away from, and being Leonora, the woman she wanted to be for the rest of her adult life. In the past 70 years, she's met Picasso, Dali, and many of the 20th century's greatest artists. She's lived in war-torn France, fled to Spain, had a nervous breakdown, and ended up in an asylum. But most of her life has been spent here in Mexico, where she's worked as a painter, writer and sculptor. Her paintings are in collections worldwide. She's one of the few women artists whose work sells for over $1 million. And her reputation continues to grow, not least because she's now the last surviving member of the original Surrealists.
Do you want a biscuit?
Well, she's regarded as one of the greatest living painters in this country. And even though she was born in England, we consider her a Mexican artist because she spent almost all her life here.
To me, Leonora has nothing of an illustrator. She never illustrates, no? She has this very deep, strong, maybe crazy story inside, and she puts it and she paints it.
And she has no pretenses. Or perhaps her only pretense is that she prefers to be unusual rather than being conventional. But it's not really a pretense. I think it comes completely naturally to her. And of course, there's this extraordinary story to tell.
And it's that extraordinary story that's brought me here to Mexico City. Leonora and I go out walking most days. A few years ago, I knew hardly anything about Leonora. After she left England, no one talked about her much at home. But when I mentioned her to a Mexican woman I sat next to at a dinner party, she was shocked by how little I knew. She said not only is Leonora the greatest living artist in Mexico, she's also an extraordinary woman. She told me to go and find her.
There are obviously sides to her that are very special, very fine, powerful features and great eyes, the marvellous smile, wonderful Edwardian voice, which hasn't changed at all.
Yes,
I found her just enthralling.
Marina Warner, whom I spoke to in London, clearly found Leonora just as captivating as I did when I found her. They met over 20 years ago. She knows her painting and her writing well.
I think the moment of crystallisation in our friendship is when I revealed to her that I had been to the same school and she had been thrown out for writing in mirror writing. The nuns thought this was very diabolical and they threw her out.
Hearing Marina talk about things like this has helped me put Leonora's story together. And though I didn't know a lot, I did, of course, know a bit from our family. Leonora, like me, was born in Lancashire. Her father was a textile magnate called Harold Carrington, and her mother was my great-aunt Maury, who was a Moorhead from Ireland.
My grandfather, Moorhead, was a doctor. His consultorio was in his own house. I loved it. What else?
I've been asking Leonora what she remembers of her childhood. She doesn't like being interviewed, but I can sometimes persuade her to talk into a microphone.
Goodness, must we go into that?
We drink tea in her kitchen, talking over the noise of her ancient fridge.
I hated being at school.
Did the nuns like you at school?
I don't think so. They thought I didn't collaborate with either work or play. My family had me, well, what they called educated. It was diseducated in how many convents? I was always requested to leave. Two, I think.
Before I came out here, I went to talk to Adam Hogg, who's a very old friend of Leonora's. His mother, Joan, was somebody Leonora met when she was a very young girl, a teenager, 15. I think Joan was about 22, so quite a bit older.
They were at Miss Penrose's academy. Miss Penrose was actually my mother's godmother, and she was one of those extraordinary English women who had migrated to Florence. But anyway, my mother was out there acting as a chaperone, and I remember Leonora saying to me that my mother was very fierce and she was very frightened of her. But the first day that Leonora had to go across Florence for an art lesson, no sooner they got out of the house and round the corner, my mother said, "Let's go and have a drink." And from that moment on, they became the best friends. Leonora's parents thought that my mother was by and large a good thing and was a good influence. Actually, she wasn't. The pair of them used to get up to appalling things together, sitting in hotel lobbies and talking about syphilitic symptoms. So the pair of them actually got up to a great deal of mischief.
Mischief, presumably, that her parents hoped could be swept under the carpet when she was brought back to London, launched as a debutante and presented to King George V at court.
I had to wear a tiara and it was biting into my skull.
She later wrote a surreal short story about this episode.
So I was in pain all the time.
In it, she describes a hyena ripping the face from a maid to use as a disguise.
What else do you want to know?
The hyena then takes the debutante's place at the ball.
She was this extraordinary mixture of being very conventional, having had a very straightforward English upper-middle-class upbringing, and then would suddenly say outrageous things or have outrageous thoughts.
Leonora was a natural surrealist. There was no need to try. Aged 75, she spoke to a British film crew.
My mother gave me Herbert Reed's book on surrealism, and there was a reproduction of Max Ernst's Deux Enfants Menacés par un Rossignol, two children being frightened of a rossignol. Is what, a nightingale, is it? I felt, this is familiar. I know what this is about. A kind of world which would move between worlds. The world of our dreaming and imagination.
So, in 1937, you met Max Ernst for the first time.
I don't remember the date or the year. I think it was at a dinner. Yeah, but let's not go into that, huh?
My mother was instrumental in getting her introduced to Max Ernst. It was Ursula Goldfinger who actually did it. My mother was responsible for driving Leonora up from the centre of London up to Highgate, where I think the Goldfingers were living in High Point at the time. Roland Penrose was there as well. But the other guest was Le Corbusier, who Leonora reported back to me some time ago. It was a very, very boring man indeed. But of course then there was Max Ernst there, and it was all a set-up, apparently. It had all been put together to try and pair them off, and it did.
I was a very good friend of Ursula, I think she was called, yeah. We were given champagne, and Max put his fingers to take the bubbles out, so I copied him. He was very easy, Max, and I liked him because it was a wonderful new world for me. He left, and then I went to Paris.
And you had to tell your parents that you'd fallen in love with Max?
Yes, I told my father. I'm not going to say that what he said.
Max Ernst was not only a companion to her, a friend, a lover, but he was also a teacher.
Thérèse Arc is an art historian and curator with a special interest in surrealist women.
He was much older. He was already an experienced artist. He was quite recognized among the surrealists because of the invention of new techniques, like frottage, for example, that Leonora used in a lot of her paintings.
Because she didn't actually have a vast amount of training as an artist, did she, when you think about it?
Not really. Leonora was mostly self-taught.
I didn't go to the De Margot, where they used to meet. I didn't go.
Leonora by now had followed Max to France, much to the dismay of my family.
I met Picasso because he lived very near in the next street, so he came over. What he liked doing was reading other people's letters that he found at my place. He did it openly, laughing. I don't think I met Marguerite. I may have done, I forget.
Duchamp?
Oh, I knew Duchamp very well.
You knew André Breton, didn't you?
Very well, yes.
And the other person you once told me you met was Miro, I think.
I only met him once. He asked me how old I was. I was very young. He wanted me to buy him cigarettes.
And what did you do?
Nothing. He wanted to send me and I refused.
Do you want another cigarette?
No. I have to get some more, I think.
How old were you when you started smoking?
When I started smoking, about 5 or 6 years old. No, that's not true. I must have been almost 10. But I use an apparatus.
A filter?
Yes. I'm addicted, like some people are addicted to opium.
Have you had enough? OK, thank you.
I've got tired now.
From the first time I came here, I've always thought Leonora's kitchen feels like a bit of Lancashire in Mexico City. It's very dark and very cold. Terracotta tiles on the floor, and there's a fairly old brown enamel cooker that looks like it came from the 1950s. In take two, her cupboard doors are postcards, views of London and pictures of the royal family. Someone's drawn a beard on Prince Charles.
La señora, sí, por favor. La señora is coming, okay.
It seems strange in a way that an artist spends a lot of her time, all of her time really, in a room that's really, really dark.
Leonora's paintings, which I have come to know, are extraordinary. She paints figures that are half human and half animal. And to me, her paintings also speak of her childhood. I see the Irish kitchen of her grandparents, the garden she played in, and the Lancashire house where she lived.
What's your earliest memory?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I don't know. Crookie.
Crookie.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Crookie?
That we had a governess, a nanny, big garden.
It was a big house, wasn't it?
Yes.
Built by Colonel Bird.
Oh, that's right, yes. Yes, you're right, yeah. How did you know that?
I went to Crookie to see it.
Ah.
And I discovered that the birds are all round the house.
Yes.
And I wondered if that's why you'd painted so many birds.
I have no idea.
Yeah, there it is. There's the house. Look there. Can you see through the trees?
Visiting Crookie was a family occasion. I took my mother and my daughter Miranda.
We found the house. It's just outside the village of Cockerham. And it's a school these days for children who've been excluded from mainstream education. When I told Leonora that, she thought it was very funny, since she herself was, of course, expelled from schools.
It's a bit sort of darker and a bit gothic with all these pillars and...
Very forbidding, yeah.
Yes. Looks almost like something you would see in a fairy tale, you know, the sort of where the wicked witch might live.
It's funny to stand here in this field and think how far away she is from it now.
I'd hate to live here as a child. It would just be scary.
It is an enormous place. When this house came up for sale in 1927, they obviously thought about buying it because they didn't own it, you see, they rented it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you can see why they went off and decided to buy Hazelwood.
Definitely.
I'm straight away to record. Hello, hello. How do you pronounce your surname, actually?
Fleurieu.
Fleurieu.
Mark Fleurieu's company has turned Hazelwood Hall, where Leonora spent her teenage years, into flats.
We're just looking through the windows into what would have been the original entrance hall to the house. It's very grand in there, isn't it?
Impressive for friends, relations. And possibly this could have been the room where Leonora had the argument with her father and she just walked out the door and left.
Could have been. Maybe it was here by this fireplace. Because she doesn't remember exactly where she was, but it was definitely in this house in 1937 when she told her father that she was off with Max. He told her to never darken the family's door again. And she never did see him again.
We're waiting with Mark for another Carrington to turn up, Rupert. As a boy, he came here to visit his grandparents, Harold and Maury.
And that was Granny's and Grandpa's room right at the end. And
well, Leonora, of course, had gone, hadn't she?
Leonora had gone, so I don't really remember where she'd slept or, you know, where it happened.
How did this happen to this lovely couple, that they had such a big rift with their only daughter?
Well, I think Prim was probably the problem, not the rest of the family.
Is it fair to say that she was seen in the family as a bit of an oddity?
A wild child. I think she was probably rebellious.
How do you think she got on with her three brothers? Your father was one of those brothers.
Well, they rather sort of poo-pooed her, really. You know, they sort of... Oh, Prim, well, you know, she can do what she wants to do. But she lived a completely different life, didn't she?
She went off to do that, yeah.
She was the odd one out. She wasn't in textiles. She didn't know anything about textiles. And that's what we were brought up in, textiles. Nobody else other than Prim had any inkling about art and anything else.
I think she found the whole kind of conventions of the English upper class extremely irksome. I mean, I know that she really didn't like her debutante dress and her going to court. And I mean, all these things were remembered, and they were painful, I think, for her. I mean, she hadn't fitted in. She was born in the wrong... She was a changeling child. She is like a changeling child, something different.
What I've been thinking about while I've been here staying at Hazelwood is how strong-willed Leonora was, how bloody-minded in a way she was about staying in Mexico and about not coming back. She'd made this break for independence and for a future in which she was an independent artist. And being in this house makes me realise what she gave up, I suppose.
When Lady Jane became a tart, it almost broke the family's heart. But pride is pride, and race is race. And so, to save the family face, they bought her the finest beat on the sunny side of German Street. You know where German Street is?
I don't think she thought when she left that she would actually never see them again, when she left for France. I think that was the shock of the war and all the vicissitudes that overtook them.
The vicissitudes Marina Warner refers to offer more insight into why Leonora ended up in Mexico. Her life with Max was halted by the arrival of the Nazis and his subsequent internment as an enemy alien. She fled to Spain, had a breakdown, and ended up in a psychiatric hospital in Santander.
I won't go into that.
My father remembered the worried conferences back home about what should happen to her. And eventually her father sent the family nanny on a warship to bring her home. But Leonora hadn't got that far as a rebel to let a world war stand in her way. She sent Nanny Carrington packing and headed for Madrid and then for Lisbon.
I was with Renata.
There, she went to the Mexican embassy for a rendezvous with a diplomat called Renato Leduc, who offered to marry her, and then they set off across the Atlantic.
Look, this is an outdoor church.
This is San Jeronimo, which is quite a sort of leafy suburb by a very nice church. It's an early morning and the sun's just coming up over the church spire, over the bell tower. Miguel Escobedo lives here. He's been Leonora's lawyer for many years. He's now, you know, a big collector of her work and has a big collection.
Du Michael, from Leonora.
She's always called you Michael, hasn't she? Yeah.
This was the first important oil painting that Leonora gave me. I can't remember what it's called, something of Gomorrah. There are two figures in the middle, both looking rather like birds, and another woman who I always used to see having a sword in her hand and a red cape. My daughter, age 5, was jumping on the sofa next to the painting, and she said, "But Daddy, she's cut her head off." It wasn't a red cape, it was blood flowing out of her body. No, it's quite extraordinary.
She was very influenced by Bosch. She saw Bosch in very extreme circumstances. She saw the Temptation of St. Anthony in the museum in Lisbon. She had made the crossing of the Pyrenees and had had the breakdown in Madrid, and she was in Lisbon waiting for the transport to New York. And she went to the museum there and saw this Hieronymus Bosch, and it made an indelible impression on her. The kind of curious mixture of grotesque and witty. You know, she's droll, she's often very droll. And so Bosch really spoke to her because he's that too.
When you've met Leonora, you know that she's weird.
Well, it was a strange time in Mexico. I mean, all these Europeans were arriving who'd
seen. Well, that's what happened. We were spending holidays in England in August 39, and my mother decided the war's going to start. So she took the first boat home, and before we got back to Mexico, the war had broken out. And yes, the boat was full of refugees, both Spanish and Jewish and everybody else. She was horrified. She threw the house open to anybody who needed help. It obviously ended up being very much the intellectual refugees who came to Mexico, the Spanish Rothschilds who turned up. Remedios Varo was part of the crowd, and a lot of the Spaniards. And Leonora was one of them. When she just simply felt that she was going to jump out of the window, she would come to the house.
they arrived here, and at the beginning they were pretty much welcome because the Surrealists were related to Trotsky. And the Mexican artists, even though they were painting about the social revolution and Indians and the past and the heritage, but they had something in common. Even Diego Rivera was helping them organize the first Surrealist exhibition in Mexico in 1940. And then some of them started parting away. The big shots in the Mexican painting were not very happy to let other people shine as well, and especially not the women. So it was not very easy for them to get recognition at the time.
I hardly knew Diego. I met him and he said, I'm Diego Rivera. And I said, I'm Huitzilopochtli, who's a very remote king of Mexico. I knew he was Diego Rivera, but I thought it was a very silly thing to say.
What you have to realize is that group that came to Mexico were a cocoon amongst themselves, and they didn't mix with the Mexicans, really.
They were quite exotic for the Mexicans. It was a very conservative country, Catholic, but some people were even scared of them.
Was it true that that Frida Kahlo said that she would rather be selling corn in the market than talking to those European bitches?
Yeah, well, people say that. She was probably jealous.
Frida? What was Frida jealous of about Leonora?
At that time in Mexico, women usually didn't even go out with their boyfriends without... how do you call it? In Mexico, it's called chaperon. Anywhere they went, people couldn't keep their eyes off them, especially men, because they were captivated by their beauty and by their conversation. They will live together with their boyfriends without being married. They will go out and do and say whatever they wanted to do, and they just were so free.
It was a marvellous period. I mean, and that matters. You know, people are lucky in their exchanges, the friends they make and who they meet. And the fact that Mexico gave this amnesty to undesirables from Europe during the Second World War did create an extraordinary community, an amazingly rich mix of people. And there was also the presence of, you know, Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera. Leonora knew all these people, and she was friends with Octavio Paz, who was one of the great writers of the century. And you know, this was an astonishing, teeming world of real creative imagination, and that helps. I mean, that's what one wants. It's that sustains artists to have that.
So this area, Colonia Roma, has been home to Leonora now for nearly 70 years. It was once bourgeois, but now it's more kind of down-at-heel bohemian. And there's music everywhere. Music spills onto every corner, from shop doorways, from tortilla kitchens, from peddlers and hawkers and vendors selling sweets and cigarettes and peanuts in the street. And all this is in stark contrast to the interior of Leonora's house.
It was a strange house because it was very austere in a way. There were two parrots, and they were known as the Sinn Feiners because they were ever protesting. There was a sort of mixture of languages spoken all the time, which became known as volapuque. It was basically French-Spanish.
When I was kindly invited to her parties, well, of course, I enjoyed them very much. There were a lot of fascinating people there.
Artist Helen Escobedo witnessed some of these surreal, socially vibrant gatherings when she was a child.
A long, long table, crowded with cups and glasses, and it was a bit of a mess. And I remember the maid tried to get through and couldn't. So she actually got on all fours and crawled under the table to get to the other side. I thought it was hysterically funny.
This is famous. One time they invited some of their friends from the Russian embassy, and they got tapioca, and they dyed it in purple and just make this joke around offering the Russians caviar. They will do all these things for fun that no one will dare to do, like in a traditional home when you had guests for dinner.
It's easy to see Leonora as the inspirational spark in the group. But by this time, she was married to Hungarian photographer Csiky Weiss, and there were children to bring up. The English art collector Edward James, who supported Salvador Dali for a while, bought some of Leonora's paintings, but she was away from the art establishment. She did some of her best work in the 1940s, 50s and 60s, and a great deal of creativity happened within the group.
One of the extraordinary things I remember, and I wish somebody could find it, was a small, very short film. They must have filmed it in a fish tank. Mm. It was breathtaking.
Many great artists do a lot of different sorts of things, and Leonora did. There you're talking about a film. She did tapestries, she did paintings.
Set designs. Costumes.
Wrote plays, wrote novels. Wrote books.
Oh, she's a brilliant writer. Brilliant. But, of course, that's another thing where she came very close. Earl Sennett, who was a well-known director and our drama teacher, wanted to put on The Madwoman of Chaillot. Leonora designed the costumes, and she wanted my mother to wear a live ostrich.
When I think about surrealism, I think about surrealism of Leonora, which is the true surrealism because she lives her own life there, no?
Oh, is it open? It is open.
It's open, but it's stiff.
There we go.
Well done. Well done.
What are we doing here?
Leonora's studio is slightly lighter than anywhere else in her house. A couple of easels. A few drawings, but they're sort of turned with their backs to the wall. Is this the room where you painted?
Yes. This is my studio.
One of the things that makes her, you know, very unusual is her ambidextrousness. You know, she paints with both hands at the same time. And I think she's the only artist I've ever heard of who does that.
Do you remember what Edward said about your studio?
No.
He said that there was hardly anything in here to make it look like an artist's studio. There were a few old paintbrushes, dogs and cats on the floor. And then he said, "My spirit soared because I knew that great art would be created here." Oh, gosh.
What do you see? Chaos. Oh, God, what's in here? Let's leave.
I remember her more than anything else. She was very keen on demons at the time. She always felt there were demons lurking around everywhere. And, you know, if there'd been an opportunity to sacrifice something, I'm sure she would have done it.
What I think you can see mostly of Mexico in Leonora's painting is this magical sense of living. She uses a lot of the symbols and ideas of esoteric groups that were very important in Mexico at the time she came here.
André Breton, you know, famously said Mexico was surrealist in itself, surrealiste par elle-même. Interesting that Mexico is feminine in French, which sort of makes it more powerful somehow. And he recognised that there was something in the language of signs, the symbols, the colour, the cult of death, Catholic cult being extremely embodied in Mexico, you know, the weeping virgins and bleeding martyrs from the Spanish tradition, but somehow spliced into the local Indian cults as well. She was drawn to their ideas about animal selves, the whole way that human beings are not hierarchically poised at the head of some sort of chain of lower beings.
Mm-hmm. Animals, you said you'd like to talk about. You're very interested in the ways in which human beings are like animals, aren't you?
We're not like animals, we are animals. So what species of animals do you want to talk about? Horses.
She once said to me that the horse was such a generous animal and that all its intelligence was in its skin. Even I, who hardly know anything about horses, remember that from my pony club, you know, that when you touch a horse, the horse quivers. The sensitivity is so great. I think that probably reflects something in her too, this kind of almost preternatural sensitivity to images, and the imagination is kind of enviably alive.
I always had access to other worlds, like we all do. We all sleep, we all dream. I think everybody. Everyone has access, but what I didn't have access to was a realistic evaluation of myself.
There's almost no membrane between her and what's going on inside her. She did say to me that she kind of trained it, you know, that she practiced the Jungian methods of hypnagogic meditation, which is actually trying to remain in that state that is between unconscious sleep and conscious ordinary awareness. And you have very, very vivid daydreams in that situation. And the surrealists advocated cultivating that state.
You may not believe in magic, but something very strange is happening. Your head has dissolved into thin air, and I can see the rhododendrons through your stomach. It's not that you are dead or anything dramatic like that. It is simply that you are fading away, and I can't even remember your name.
The Hearing Trumpet is a true classic. I mean, it's not just a surrealist classic, it is a surrealist classic, but it is an extraordinary tour de force.
Leonora's novel, The Hearing Trumpet, is still in print. It was written many years ago in Mexico. It's about old age, but she wrote it long before she was old herself.
It's a terrific fantasy involving, oddly enough, some of the things that have turned up now in Dan Brown. Lots of wicked nuns and priests. But she projects herself into the character of a very, very old crone.
Strangely prophetic, the central character is a feisty 92-year-old stuck in a Spanish-speaking country and longing to go home.
I never could understand this country, and now I am beginning to be afraid that I never will get back to the north. For the last 45 years, I have been trying to get away. Somehow I never could. There must be a binding spell which keeps me in this country.
Do you remember writing that?
No.
And she also produced this remarkable classic of madness, Down Below. And because she had been through this appalling crisis and had a really bad psychotic episode, Leonora gives a very dramatic and close account of how it feels to be completely bonkers.
The task of the right eye is to peer into the telescope, while the left eye peers into the microscope. Leonora writes that in Down Below, and it's pretty analogous to the way I've been trying to look at her life. Gracias. Her marriage to Cheeky lasted 60 years. Though they did spend some time apart.
I'm going to go see if I have it upstairs.
This is Elena Poniatowska, looking for a photograph of Leonora for me.
I think I saw it 3 days ago.
She's a novelist, poet, and she's a political journalist who published testimony from the student massacre in Mexico in 1968.
Leonora is always scared, ever since she was in that asylum, and then to leave Europe and leave everything behind. I think at the bottom of her heart, she's scared. For instance, in 1968, the way she fled, taking her two boys, I think that others would not have gone.
Do you know much about the events for her around that time, why she went?
After 1968, and so many students were put in jail, and then when many students were killed, everything changed. The wife of Octavio Paz, Elena Garro, she didn't like Leonora. She was jealous of Leonora because Octavio Paz cared so much for Leonora. So she gave Leonora's name, just like a crazy thing, in the midst of all the other intellectuals. They had nothing to do with the students' movement except they approved of it, but they weren't militants. So. But she got very afraid and she left. So that's why the children left Mexico, and Leonora also left Mexico.
She went to America at that point.
To New Orleans?
Yes.
No?
Yeah, so when she got to New Orleans, she got off. She got off the plane and wouldn't get on again.
That was a famous occasion when she insisted on wearing her life jacket throughout the flight. And she got on the plane and put it on, and no one could persuade her to take it off. But the story was that the plane actually had to put down in New Orleans because it had engine trouble. Or there was something wrong with it. At least that was the story I had. And she refused to get back on the plane again. She thought, so she went all the way to New York by bus.
One of her phobias is flying and also actually living upstairs. So when I knew her, she lived in a basement flat, not very nice, and in New York, of course, not even considered very safe. But she absolutely insisted on it. And so she really likes being in a burrow. And a lot of her animal familiars, apart from the horse, which is probably her chief animal familiar, are actually small animals or burrowing animals. I mean, she has lots of badgers in her work. So it's not even a burrow, it's a kind of set. And if you think about the imagery in her paintings, there are often caves, there are often sort of labyrinths, warrens, subterranean chambers. And that's part of her, I think, this sort of search for safety that she has.
Alan told me, while I think of it, that Gloria is arriving on Sunday.
Gosh, where did I meet Gloria? I don't remember.
You knew her in New York?
Back in 1971, I was a graduate student at NYU writing on comparative literature, and my field was surrealism. And I needed to find surrealists in Latin America who had come there after the war. And a friend of mine knew of Leonora Carrington.
This is Gloria.
I had really not heard of her.
Gloria Orenstein.
She was interested in knowing why the women were burning their bras in New York. And I said, well,
Gloria and Leonora started writing to each other.
And she sent me money to buy books for her on the women's movement. And she wanted to know everything about it. And she wished she could be there participating in it and things like that.
Gloria and Leonora met finally when Leonora turned up in New York.
It happened that Betty Friedan was speaking in New York. So we went to hear Betty Friedan, and I just found a little sort of like a diary entry that I made for that whole encounter with Leonora. And it turns out that we met with her and some other feminists. Then they were important feminists.
Have you ever seen yourself as a feminist?
Yes, I think it goes back a long way. I had three brothers, all bigger than me and stronger than me. And they used to throw stones at me. I remember that.
The surrealists in Paris clearly didn't see women as their equals.
They ignored me, I think. Women can't paint, according to my earlier time. What can you say? Bullshit. Huh? That's what I should have said.
We had all been so mesmerised by the beauty and glamour of these surreal muses, like Lee Miller in Man Ray's photographs, even Dora Maar in Picasso and so forth. So we had a sense of all these women who had occupied the imaginations of men and been their objects of desire. And we were aware of the philosophy that women were the sort of the gateway of dream for surrealists. But this had not been the case only. There was a sudden recognition that there had been women surrealist artists, and they had been sort of written out of history, and that they were very good.
It's been a while since art historians have been paying much more attention to women artists than they did before. And I don't think there's any way back.
Leonora's work can currently be seen in exhibitions along with other great surrealists. And although until now she's largely been ignored by public collections in Britain, there are plans to put that right.
She's more recognised, I will say, in the United States than in Europe. And of course, for Mexico, she's like a national treasure.
I've been amazed sometimes at how widely known Leonora is in Mexico. When we're out for a walk together, she's stopped the whole time. In some ways, it's a shame I waited so long to come looking for her. But in other ways, it was the right time.
The trouble with being 92 is that a lot of your friends aren't here anymore.
Pardon?
A lot of your friends aren't alive anymore. A sort of downside.
There's no way of stopping either being 92 or people dying.
But I do always think, though, that in the same way that you've protested at other times in your life, that you're protesting against old age.
Wouldn't know. Here and there.
She's always been like that, the way she is now.
Sitting in her kitchen a year ago, hadn't changed one bit.
Of course, she, you know, seems to forget things or have lapses of memory of different things, but She's just got that same spirit inside of her that I knew.
Could you have been anything but an artist?
No, well, you're born an artist.
That Leonora has changed, I have my doubts.
So you don't do it, it does you.
Leonora lives very much in her own
world. Do you miss it, Lancashire?
I'm not sure about that. I don't think I'll go back now. Lancashire born, Lancashire bred, strong in the arm and weak in the head.
I'm from Lancashire too, you know. You thought you'd seen the back of us all a long time ago.
No, I didn't think about it. Well, this is a good surprise.
Have a good trip. Bye. See you soon. Bye-bye. The first few times I left was kind of harder because I thought, oh, I wonder if I'll ever see Leonora again. But now, I've come back so often. She tells me she's very keen to get to be 100. There's always the chance that'll be the last time I've seen her. But I feel I've been very lucky to know her.
That was Looking for Leonora. It was presented by Joanna Moorhead and the programme was produced by Tamsin Hughes. It was a Wise Buddha production for BBC Radio 3 and the programme was first broadcast in July last year. We have two more features for you this week during the proms. On Wednesday evening, after the prom, you can hear Edward Sturton reflecting on the life and the legacy of Cardinal Newman in a programme called A Very English Saint. That's at 10:15 on Wednesday. And on Friday, we meet Tolstoy in the Cotswolds. There's a profile of the village in Gloucestershire that was the home of the community founded on Tolstoy's principles. Tolstoy in the Cotswolds is on Friday evening. It begins at 10 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. At 11:15 tonight, Max Reinhardt introduces tonight's edition of Late Junction. But with the time now at 10 o'clock tonight, it's time for the second of our two proms this evening. It's introduced from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall in London by Petroc Trelawney.
Good evening. We welcome listeners on BBC Radio 3 and our audience here at the Royal Albert Hall to the first late night prom of the 2011 season. The lights are low as we prepare to hear one of the greatest works of the chamber music canon, Schubert's String Quintet, played by the Belcher Quartet, joined by cellist Valentin Urben, who for nearly 30 years was a member of the Alban Berg Quartet. In the autumn of 1828, Schubert moved to the Viennese suburbs, to his brother's house, where he hoped the country air would somehow improve his health. It turned out to be the last place that he would live, but in the weeks before he died, that November, he wrote a series of major works, the three last piano sonatas and this quintet. It was as if he was desperate to get his ideas down on paper before it was too late. During this time, Schubert played viola in a private performance of Beethoven's late C-sharp minor string quartet, an experience that apparently sent him into such transports of delight and enthusiasm that all feared for him. Could that experience have provoked a desire to emulate his hero and leave the world his own great chamber music masterpiece? Well, the shadow of mortality is never far away from what is a work that lasts very nearly an hour. Arthur Rubinstein requested the slow movement to be played at his funeral. The novelist Thomas Mann remarked that this was music one would like to hear on one's deathbed. The Belcher Quartet are violinists Karina Belcher-Fischer and Axel Schacher, viola player Krzysztof Hojelski, and cellist Antoine Ludelin, joined this evening by cellist Valentin Urben. Please welcome them to the stage to play Schubert's String Quintet in C.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.